Welcome to Losing My Religion, a podcast for and maybe about you. Joe Armstrong here. Last month, I was interviewed by Scott Stalaker for his YouTube channel, The Atheist View, Life Without Religion. Scott is an author, musician, and host of this really interesting channel. He's also the author of three books. He wrote a memoir, Picking Wings Off Butterflies, the novel Blind Guides, and a self-help guide, How to Escape Religion Guilt-Free. He's an avid musician, a multi-instrumentalist, and he has recorded and produced two CDs, Rainforest Dance and a self-titled debut. He also serves on the board of the Clergy Project, a non-profit organisation based in the US that provides peer support to current and former religious leaders who no longer believe in a God. Here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to The Atheist View, Life Without Religion. Join me in my conversation today with Joe Armstrong, who hails all the way from Dublin, Ireland. Joe happened to spend 9 years studying to be a Catholic priest before parting ways with religion. He's an award-winning speaker and an accomplished author.
Oh, in Dublin's fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first set my eyes on sweet Molly Malone. As she wheeled her wheelbarrow through streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. Scott, I feel like I've known you all my life, and yet where have you been all my life?
I feel the same way.
You're a musician, Scott. I've heard some of your music, and you are so talented.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Are you a U2 fan?
Absolutely. More. Absolute. It comes with birth, you see. If you have an Irish passport, you have to be into U2. And if you're not into U2, you lose your Irish passport. That's the way it works.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So my next question
Bono,
was...
Bono, in fact, of the U2, lead singer with U2, went to and the rest of them, they went to school in a place called Mount Temple in Dublin. And Mount Temple was, I'm guessing, about maybe, I don't know, at rough guess, 500 yards away from my school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I
That's
went
super
and
close.
Really what? Super close. And he, you know, they started off as a young band, and he's only 2 years. I'll be 62 in April.
Right, right.
And Bono was 1 or 2 years older than I am. And I'm thinking, like, if I didn't get caught up in all this God stuff when I was a kid, if I hadn't been, I could have been sent to Mount Temple, where he went.
Wow.
And I could have been in U2.
You could have been there. That's how life goes, you know? Well, you know, I hear it's, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. Apparently my wife and my daughter met Bono and The Edge at a NAMM show. I don't know if you know what a NAMM show is. It's a big conference for musicians and the music industry and such. And so they always have celebrities that are running around. So I've got a picture of her with Bono and The Edge at one of these NAMM shows.
And they've been doing a residency, haven't they? I think, is it in Las Vegas? Somewhere in the States anyway.
You know, I'm not sure. And I hear they started out as a Christian band.
They did. And in fact, I don't know whether they still do, but they used to go on U2 retreats where they would, the music on this sort of spiritual retreat would all be from U2.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they have that kind of spiritual flair to their music.
They do.
I think.
Excuse me, I need to turn off my phone because it just beeped. And we can't be having that. I mean, we can't be having that at all, can we? So I'm just turning off.
Yeah, I'm wondering where their head is at these days. I think maybe they're more in line with humanist values, personally, I think.
I suspect so, but I can't be sure.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, yeah.
At our book launch, we played a new song, which I'd love to play to you, but I kind of can't because it hasn't been released yet. So it was kind of like a sneak preview.
Right.
But I find it so emotional, and it's all about my story, you know, of the first verse is about going to the seminary and Do you know what it's like? Do you know what it's like? It's like those love stories, not love stories, where you're in a bad relationship with somebody and you're trying to break out of it. And two verses in it. And I'm very proud of packing so much of a life story into two verses. Of course, I didn't do it just myself, far from it. I've got a wonderful singer called The Rain, or A-Y-N-E.
Very nice.
He's on Spotify. And right. Andrea Petron. And the three of us worked on this song. And every time I hear it, I cry. It's that powerful for me.
So let me ask you, did you grow up as a Catholic or as a, obviously not a Protestant? You know, maybe you can kind of talk to us about this friction that's there in Ireland between the Catholics and the Irish.
The Catholics and the Protestants. I grew up as a Catholic, and I suppose I would now loosely describe myself as a humanist or an atheist. And there's right. this famous story about this guy who stopped at the height of the troubles in Northern Ireland and by paramilitaries. And he says, "Are you a Catholic or are you a Protestant?" And he says, "I'm a humanist." And your man comes back and says, "But are you a Catholic humanist or a Protestant humanist?"
It makes a difference.
But yeah, my mother was steeped in religion, never questioned anything. Like even as a kid, I remember watching her and thinking, how could she not question things?
Right.
And yet I, in turn, because you're so, you know, as the Jesuits said, and probably some Chinese philosopher said before any Jesuit said it, you know, give me the child until he's seven and I'll show you the man. So yeah, the Catholics had me until I was seven. So I spent the rest of my life trying to unthink the pathways in my brain, which were miswired in those crucial years. And not just in your brain, like it's not only just how you think, it's also how you feel, how you make decisions, how you identify. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is just so deep.
Mm-hmm. It's
and they're still at it. They're still at it. They're still indoctrinating kids into religions all over the world. It's shocking.
Yeah. I started to leave the church when my daughter was about 4 or 5 and my son was 3 or 4 years older than that. And there's a huge difference in the way that they think. Mm. So we pulled out of that. So my daughter really didn't have that kind of indoctrination or anything. And she's got a really good bullshit detector. I mean, she's spot on, you know, whereas my son has a little bit more trouble with it.
I'm afraid I was spewing out all that kind of stuff until embarrassingly late in my life.
When did you decide to, you know, go into the ministry to become a priest?
A priest, yeah. I was at school. I joined when I was 18, so I kind of decided when I was 17. But when I was a kid, I have this little cameo in the first memoir, and My God, I Don't Believe. And it shows me as a young kid. And you know the way... Well, children get lost in their imagination. They're not aware of people looking at them and so on. And I was in the back room, our living room at home, terraced house in Donnycarney, which is northern part of Dublin. It still is northern part of Dublin, about 3 miles from the centre of the city. And there I was, lost in my own reverie. And what I was doing was I was doing the gestures of a priest at Mass, you know, all this stuff, and entirely unaware of the fact that my parents were watching me, totally in my little world.
Right.
And then...
And how old were you again?
18? I was very... Oh, no, that wasn't when I was 18.
This was before that then.
I'm guessing before I was 7, you know.
Right.
This was as a very, very young boy.
Mm-hmm.
Which just shows you how you absorb this stuff, you catch it, you know. Faith isn't taught, it's caught like a flu. Anyway, I suddenly became embarrassed because I realized, oh, sweet God. See, there you go. You know, an atheist doesn't grow up saying, oh, sweet God, or oh, sweet Jesus, do they? But it's part of my linguistic way of being in the world.
Right, right.
And I heard my father say, oh, watching me doing the Mass thing, oh, we might have a priest in the family. And I was mortified. I was mortified because I thought that was exactly what I was doing. You know, if I'd grown up in a musical family, I might have imagined myself on the stage, you know, Johnny Cash or whoever it might be.
Yeah.
If I'd been in a sporting family, I might have imagined myself playing, you know, if it was American baseball or soccer or Gaelic, Irish football, hurling, whatever.
Right, right.
No, religious family. So I was identifying with the priest, and the priest was a guy whom people looked up to and seemed to know everything. And people went to confession, lined up to go to confession. Like when I was a kid, the whole parish, there were about seven masses in the largest church in all of Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Huge church. And it was packed seven times of a Sunday.
Wow.
Mm. But on the Saturday night, because you had to go to confession in order to be able to receive the Eucharist the next day.
Oh, I see.
Because otherwise you would be receiving in a state of mortal sin or whatever it might be. And people used to line up to go to these priests. And in that parish alone, I'm sure there were at least seven priests, you know, back in the 1960s.
That aspect of Catholicism, the confession, is really strange to me as a Protestant, as a former Protestant.
It's perverse. I mean, when I go on occasion, I will go to Mass. Maybe I'm at a funeral or something and they're having a Catholic Mass. And I am just reacting every moment. Like from the word go, it's all about we are sinners. We have sinned most grievously. Lord have mercy. Christ have mercy. Lord have mercy. And I'm thinking, hello? hello? What? And this is the view of oneself that you pick up as a young Catholic, that we're all sinners and we needed Jesus to save us.
Yeah. I was wondering, I don't think it's this way with Protestants, but I was wondering if there's a lot of liturgical elements to Catholicism, rites and this and that, and there is so with like Lutherans as well. But I was wondering if you were attracted to that dynamic of it. You know, you mentioned at an early age, kind of going through the motions with your hands. And do you recall that being a fascination for you?
Yes and no. I remember Mass being unutterably boring, utterly, utterly, totally boring. But I also remember special liturgies like the Easter Vigil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Catholicism is really good at appealing to the senses. So in the Easter Vigil, which would be, you know, Holy Saturday night, leading into midnight on Easter Sunday morning, Jesus is risen.
Right.
And the church, if you can imagine being this massive, massive church, which is packed with people at midnight, and all of the lights are turned off, and then the Paschal candle is lit, one solitary candle in the entire darkness of the church. And then the priest cries out, Christ our light, and everybody goes, imagine, like thousands of people, thanks be to God. You know, the hair was standing on your back.
Yeah.
Very dramatic because the liturgy and the theatre are very, very associated in how they originated. And so you have there light and darkness. Then you have sound, singing. You have colour. You have the vestments. You have the flowers.
Pomp and circumstances is what comes
to mind. Yeah, but it appeals to all the senses. And then you have incense. So you have the aroma of incense, which is a beautiful smell. So it appeals to all of the senses. So it's a very sensory religion.
Yeah, sensory.
Compared to some of the Protestant religions, which are very stripped back and didn't have any, you know, some of them didn't have any pictures or icons or what have you.
Correct. Yeah. No, it's very true. I was a Lutheran, and Lutherans are quite liturgical. I recall going back, I've only been back a couple of times to attend church, I think once for my father's funeral, and I just couldn't get over it. It's, you know, at 10:10 you do this, and at 10:12 you kneel down and give this chant, and it was very liturgical. On the other hand, Adventists are completely opposite of that. Very little pomp and circumstance, very little rituals in the church services. But I can totally see how a person would be drawn to that, especially how it affects all of your senses. It almost seems like a theater to me. You suppose that's intentional, or it's just kind of evolved over time?
And then I would have become involved in the Catholic Charismatic Renewal in the late 1970s. So I would have been, I don't know, 16, 17, that kind of age. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it was all personal and to do with feelings and, you know, this, there was excitement and enthusiasm compared to the boredom of so many parish masses, you know, which weren't like that Easter vigil, like most of them were just boring.
Yeah.
People were coughing and looking at their watch and hoping the priest wouldn't give a long sermon. So that kind of caught me up in the enthusiasm, you know, religious enthusiasm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I have a wonderful letter in my first book, the In My God I Don't Believe, which recounts that period, where I'm writing to my uncle, who is a priest in South Africa, and I'm so excited because I've suddenly found Jesus. I don't know where I found him. I'm still looking, I guess. But I write this letter to my Uncle John, who I loved. He was a gorgeous guy, and he was a priest, and he had a magnificent mm-hmm. story, which itself was part of my faith story, because he had had TB, and he spent 11 years in hospital with TB, 11 years. And this was, you know, before there was surgery and other medical mm-hmm. procedures and interventions. Mm-hmm. So at that time, you got TB, you were a goner. So 11 years, a long time to be in a hospital.
That's a very long time.
The story which he would often recount was that during all of that time, he used to pray a ridiculous prayer, which was, Lord, make me your priest. Like people, mm-hmm. But guess what happened? Surgery, medicine moves on. He has an operation.
Right.
They remove one lung and he's left with kind of half of one lung, but it's enough for him to get out and about. And he writes to Archbishop McCann in South Africa, saying he wants to be a priest. Now, Archbishop McCann writes back to him and says, report to the Beda College in Rome, which was for late vocations, which he duly did. And he was ordained a priest. And my mother and my father were at his ordination in Rome and got engaged at his ordination in Rome. So there's a connection again.
Yeah.
And then there's this letter, when I was researching the first memoir, there's this letter, which I discovered in relatively recent years, where my uncle is writing to my mother before I'm born or conceived, saying to her, someday you may have a son yourself, and who knows, with God's grace, he might be a priest. That was the family, and that was the Ireland into which I was born.
Yeah, yeah. That's tough to live down.
Well,
did your mom kind of groom you for that situation, or your...
No, she didn't really. Like, I think I didn't have a good relationship with her, a very dysfunctional relationship with her. And to be honest, I never actually knew whether she was happy I was there or not. Mm-hmm. And to be fair to her, even though we had a difficult relationship, when I left, she took it very well. And she wrote me a letter, which was very mature and, you know, admiring me for my courage in leaving and so on. Mm-hmm. So no, there are, of course, many, many men, probably older than me, you know, maybe 20 years older than me, who would now be in their 80s or whatever. And if they left their studies for the priesthood in Ireland at that time, they were called a spoiled priest. And there was a shame. And the mother would often not talk to the son again or whatever. She felt ashamed that he hadn't gone ahead and become a priest.
That can happen now in some churches.
Really, still.
Yeah, that can happen now in some churches. You know,
in fact, America, to my mind, you know, as an outsider, because I'm in Ireland, America seems to me, especially sort of Bible Belt America, MAGA America,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it seems to me to be very much like Ireland was in many respects back in the 1950s, where you had this, you know, everybody was a believer kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And dare you come out and say, well, I don't believe in any of that nonsense.
So I'm really curious, you know, what's your impression of MAGA and the religious environment here in the U.S.? For right or wrong, it's your impression, you know?
For right or wrong, I'm appalled by it. Because, I mean, literally, Ireland has been on this trajectory from what was in effect a theocratic state. The constitution is almost Catholic, the Irish mm-hmm. constitution. Mm-hmm. And we're gradually trying to unravel that and replace it with secular amendments to the constitution. But, you know, but I grew up in that hyper religious environment. And I'm appalled to realize that that is alive and well in America. It's just scary. And maybe more of it is, is, you know, of the kind of low church Protestant, you know, not in any derogative sense, but, you know, the high church being the more high Anglican and Roman Catholic stuff of bells and whistles and incense and, you know, the stripped back low church stuff of, you know, no icons and no images, blah, de blah. But it's scary. And the fact that, you guys in America very often seem to have a real difficulty in, quote unquote, coming out as an atheist, whereas Ireland has very happily had this totally opposite trajectory whereby, you know, it's the people who feel embarrassed these days tend to be the religious. Like there were 20 guys who joined the seminary with me, 20, imagine 20 guys, 17 of us left.
That's interesting. And
yeah, it's very interesting, but
it reminds me of when I was going to school, and I think it was in a homiletics class, you know, which is the art of preaching kind of class. And one of the professors came in one time and he said, basically, one in four of you, well, three quarters of you will be gone. Basically, only 25% of you are actually going to stay for a little while. The rest of you will not be in the ministry in 5 or 10 years. Very similar situation.
Yeah. I remember when I was in the seminary and guys would leave and I think, God, this is awful and feeling shattered. And, you know, because you immediately thought, well, why am I still staying? But then I remember getting to the point where I thought, you know, I actually don't need to explain why I'm leaving. The three who stay are the people who actually need to, you know, why am I staying? You know, in light of all of the facts.
It's more like, what's wrong with me? Why am I staying? Why do these other people have it figured out? Is it that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I used to find it really, especially if somebody, it was a good friend, if a good friend left.
Yeah.
And you'd feel, oh my God, I don't even see him because I'm just so gutted that he's gone. Because part of the joy of it was that there were 20 of us and we're all setting out to save the world.
Right.
And we all identified as members of this religious congregation. And you know, being part of a community meant something. But then when they all just went away, or most of them went away, I kind of thought, well, it's not the same thing. Like, you know, would I still stay here if they all left? And I thought, well, no, because it's a different deal, because it's no longer about being community.
Right. Well, there's a lot of things that come out in your book. And one of the things that touched me was, is you seem to have some really good relationships with these folks that you're talking about, and probably still do, I'm guessing.
I do. Yeah. I do. I think two of them were at the book launch for the second memoir, Saved by a Woman, last week. And one of them made a really, really perceptive intervention. One of the themes that both memoirs explores is my sexuality and how, you know, I think especially within Catholicism, you're kind of taught that sex is bad, sex is sinful. You know, you're taught this.
Right.
And, you know, I had a bad thought. You know, because you had a sexual fantasy or something like that. It's such a negative view of the human person. And then it loads you with guilt. And then you have to go to confession, which, you know, reinforces the role of the priest. And, you know, it's just this vicious man-made cycle of guilt, forgiveness. And it's all manufactured by these crazy notions, which are infused into our minds, mentalities, feelings, emotions, and bodies from before we know our name, you know?
Right.
But anyway, so there were two guys there who were in a novitiate with me back in 1980 at the launch. But John O'Sullivan, he made a really interesting observation about, because, yeah, he was talking about, he admired how my books explored how, you know, sexuality is a continuum. You know, very few people are 100% gay and very few people are 100% straight. And most people are somewhere along that spectrum. And he was admiring the fact that I was being open in my explorations about, you know, where do I stand? You know, when you're in a seminary, you're only guys there, you know.
Exactly.
So you don't have the opportunity of doing what the normal thing to do, you know, you're with men and women.
Right.
And you will explore your sexuality with men and women. But in a situation where there are only guys there, you know, it's a very artificial setup. And plus, within Catholicism, yeah. I mean, women get a really bad time, not only in scripture, but the fact that women aren't ordained priests in the Catholic Church, they're not ordained deacons. And, you know, you're told that Eve mm-hmm. brought sin into the world. And yes. the only way that Mary could redeem that sin of Eve, because it's always the women, mm-hmm. the only way that Mary, the Mother of God, could undo that was that she was born without the stain of original sin, which is another poppycock invented notion in order mm-hmm. to perpetuate this idea that we need to be saved.
Crazy.
Yeah.
When did you first start to doubt it then? And did you doubt Catholicism, or were you doubting, you know, the existence of God? How did that play out for you?
Well, how it played out for me was when I decided that it was all a load of bunkum. I wasn't just saying Catholicism is a load of bunkum. I was saying it's all a load of bunkum. It was kind of like the conceit that Catholicism had it right kind of made sense. So if I judged that they had it wrong and they were believing in a tissue of lies, it was kind of like, yeah, so they're all believing
these lies. They're all bad, yeah, yeah.
They're all believing these lies.
My experience was similar. Maybe that's just the way it goes. You're taught, or you want to believe that your church is the right one. It's teaching the right doctrine. Everybody else is wrong. So when that goes, everything kind of goes.
Like, for example, I remember going to, you know, I had 9 years studying. So
yeah,
you know,
9 years.
Philosophy, theology, all that kind of stuff. So I did it all. And really, I'm glad I did it all, because it sort of provided me with the intellectual basis for coming to my personal judgment that it is all a load of BS. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Made up stuff, big, big lie. And I believed it. You know, I believed it. And that's kind of the scary thing. But then again, another part of me didn't ever believe it. Like, talking about the continuum of sexuality, I think there's mm-hmm. also a continuum of faith and doubt. And that, I think I always had this, do I believe it, don't? It was always kind of, well, if God exists, then it makes sense for me to be a priest. But it was always predicated on that big if. You know, if Jesus died and saved us and all that kind of stuff, then why would you be playing golf? I mean, it's got to make a difference in your life.
Right.
You know, so I couldn't understand how people could just take it all in and go off and drink and earn money in banks and stuff. I thought, well, surely if that's true, it has got to make a radical difference to our lives.
Right.
So it was always if. And I had loads of vocational crises along the way. I think maybe the thing that, you know, obviously theology, you learn theology, you think, you know, there's no actual resurrection account in the Gospels. Like they're all added on. Mark, the earliest Gospel, has no resurrection narrative in its original form. And the bit about the risen Jesus was added later. And you kind of think, what? How much later? And then you think, years and years and years later. What, like before people could write and have internet and all that? Yeah. So something happened 30 years ago and the entire church is believing it? It's crazy.
I remember, go ahead. No, I was going to say, I remember I was a smart person, or at least I thought I was pretty smart when I entered my freshman year of college. And then you have this rude awakening once you start learning things, you know, about the Bible, and you start studying Greek, and you start learning about these issues and everything. And for me, it was almost counterproductive. It's suddenly you realize how much you don't know, you know. And I think that in itself was pretty humbling for me. That helped kind of push me out the door. At least it helped me realize that my particular religion did not represent the truth, and that there were other things out there that I should. Other religions that were perhaps as valid, or at least had some valid points.
Hmm. A crunch point for me was that when you're studying for the Catholic priesthood, there are certain, I was in a religious order. So after first year, at the end of first year, you would apply for first profession. So you were no longer a novice, you are then a temporarily professed member of the congregation. in my case, the Marist Fathers, the Père Mariste French order.
Right.
And that, you know, then you would renew your vows, you know, take vows for a year or 3 years, whatever it was. But finally, you would take final profession, and then that was you committing yourself to like for your life to them, and them committing themselves.
Yeah, you bring that out life. In your book. I mean, you seem to have been right at that cusp before making that decision.
Thank you for reading my book, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. I enjoyed it.
But then there's, after that, there's diaconate, where you become a deacon. Mm-hmm. And again, you apply for it and you go through, retreats and all this kind of stuff. And you decide, yes, I'm going ahead, and you apply. And then finally apply for ordination. And then they sit down and say yes or no and all that kind of stuff. So there are all these steps. Now, there are two things which seriously undermine my faith. One is that the theory, the theology is that the vocation comes from God. And when I got to diaconate year, the year I could have become a deacon, and I applied for diaconate, and I was duly called to diaconate. And my ordination to diaconate would have gone ahead, I think, that December, so coming up to Christmas anyway. Mm-hmm. Which was the middle of my third year of theology and the middle of my ninth year studying for the priesthood. And they suddenly changed the rules in the Vatican, right? So up to that, most guys were ordained deacon in their third year. But they changed the rule so that you had to have finished your third year. So I had formally been called by the congregation, by the province I belonged to, to mm-hmm. become a deacon before Christmas. It's been announced and all this kind of stuff. Right. And then the Vatican decided that nobody in their third year would be ordained a deacon. And for me, I thought, hang on a bit. I thought a vocation came from God. And you taught me to believe that God called me to become a deacon. And that it was sort of an administrative thing. Yeah, you verified all that kind of stuff. But it was like mm-hmm. a confirmation of this call from God. So I have got this call from God because I've formally been called by the province, by right. the congregation, by yeah. this, to the
diaconate. It is settled in your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it kind mm-hmm. of reaffirms this stupid yeah. and crazy belief that Joe Armstrong or anybody has been personally called by God mm-hmm. to become a priest or a deacon or whatever it is. And then suddenly the Vatican changed its rules.
Technicality. And they said, no.
So then I thought, well, hang on a bit. Did God call me to the priesthood last, or to the diaconate last week? Well, God has changed his mind because the Vatican changed their rules. And I thought, that's dumb. And then another thing. So I thought, mm-hmm. this isn't true of God at all. It's just an administrative thing. And then the other thing that really exploded my faith was that the Catholic Church teaches and admits that compulsory celibacy for priests is only mm-hmm. a man-made rule. They admit that. Mm-hmm. But they still pretend that the vocation to the priesthood is from God. So the man-made rule of compulsory celibacy is a man-made rule made up by the church, which they enforce. So what happens then if a guy falls in love or whatever, gets married or wants to get married? They require the priest, who always remains a priest within Catholic theology, there's no such thing within Catholic theology as an ex-priest. But they actually require the priest not to exercise his priesthood almost ever, because they elevate what they admit to be a man-made rule above what they claim to be God's call of this man to the priesthood.
Right.
I thought, how could they believe that, perpetuate that, and act on it? They're telling these guys, God called you to the priesthood, and we're confirming that. And then the next breath they're saying, yeah, well, even though God called you, we're not going to let you work as a priest because you've broken the man-made rule of celibacy. Stupid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's still the case. And what priests have to do, priests who fall in love or get married or whatever, they have to make a choice, in effect, to admit either that they were mad or bad be ordained a priest, mad or bad. Mm-hmm. And if they kind of sign this documentation, which will say they're either mad or bad, they will get dispensation. But the dispensation isn't from the priesthood. Because once priesthood has been conferred within Catholic theology, you can't have it back. So even, paedophile priests, insane priests, murdering priests, whoever, they're priests till their dying day, no matter what they've done.
Right.
You know, it's an indelible ontological change that takes place. The nonsense that we were taught. Yeah. But that is Catholic theology. Don't get me going.
No, no. I think, you know, I can trace my departure too to a couple of events, but I'm also wondering, I think we always have a little bit of a doubt in there. You know, you mentioned having that yourself. You always kind of questioned it, which I did as well. And I got a feeling most Christians are kind of questioning it all the time.
Yeah, they do. You know? But the interesting thing is that once you have discarded your belief in Santa, God, mm-hmm. once you've outgrown that silly belief, and once you realize this is my one and only life, there isn't a life after this. Well, other than the fact that my cells will feed trees. I'm not a scientist or a physicist, but I understand the sense that you know, non-destructibility of matter, whatever. But me, in any sense of a corporeal, spiritual sense, I'm gone. When I die, that's it, folks. So enjoy now. Live the life you want to live now. It's the only one you got.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, the anger that I justifiably feel when you kind of realize in your late 20s, I've believed this nonsense all my life. People told me this lie and I believed it. You know? Mm-hmm. And I've often asked elderly priests or elderly nuns, how would you assess your life if you woke up tomorrow and you just knew it was all BS? You've lived a lie. You've believed a lie. You swallowed it hook, line and sinker.
Mm-hmm.
How would you feel? And they always, I can see by them because they're not stupid.
Right.
And they have lived their lives with that sense of, well, what if it's all just made up baloney?
Yeah. And I'm sure it's in the back of their mind.
It has to be.
But they can't admit it. You know, it's a difficult thing to admit.
Well, sometimes they do, you know, and they, mm-hmm. they
just go with
acknowledge
it
as a real possibility. And why wouldn't they, you know?
Yeah.
But I think the longer they're there, the harder it is for them to
I think
say
so
I've
too.
Been living a lie all my life.
So you've done, you know, obviously you've written a couple of books. You're into music. You've done a lot of writing. I was wondering, because it certainly played into my effect, you know, my reasoning for leaving the church is that I have a lot of creative outlets. And to me, I found that the church was very stifling in that regard. Mm. There's a lot of things I gave up, you know, just because you operate on this imperative that Jesus is, you might not even finish school before Jesus comes. That's the imperative that you operate under. But once you are free of that, for me, you know, it just set loose my creativity.
Yeah, I realized I couldn't stay also because deep down I'm a writer. It's my primordial vocation. It's who I am. I'm a writer. And I've been writing, you know, columns and books and, you know, for a long time now. And I realized I can't be a writer and be a priest because I would have to toe the party line. And I can't do that. You know, as a writer, I couldn't be true to myself as a writer.
Well, in your book, Saved by a Woman, that comes out early. That tension comes out early to me. Mm-hmm. To me, that's kind of like the backdrop of the book, is that you really wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. You know, that was ultimately what separated you from the church.
It's true. So I'm really glad I did want to be a writer because I realized, no, I'm being confined, my thoughts, my creativity, my self-expression. I can't be me as a priest because me would be very different to the party line on so many issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really glad about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. Writing the memoirs was an amazing experience for me because I wrote them primarily to help me to understand myself. I'd done a documentary for Irish National Radio, RTE. I got an award, New York Festival's World Best Radio Award. I'm very, very proud of that.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
Anyway, I did this documentary and I cried my eyes out doing it. It was so cathartic for me. And it was a story of my time in the seminary. But I had to get it all into 40 minutes, plus they wanted other voices. So the mate I talked about who was at the book launch last week, this night last week, he was one of the other voices, John O'Sullivan, mm-hmm. and another guy, Declan Wynne, who has since died. In fact, there was a fourth one, Ronnie Balfe, but the supervisor said, no, look, we can't have four voices. You know, it's only 40 minutes. It's just, so we had to reduce it down to three voices, mine and Declan and John. And it was just so cathartic, right, doing that documentary. And it was really when I'd finished that documentary that I realized that there was so much more to tell and so much more for me to explore, and that I needed to write a book. And so that was the first memoir in my book, mm-hmm. But I Don't Believe, and it told the story of my childhood and the influences of Catholicism and growing up in Ireland at that time, mm-hmm. which is pretty much like America, parts of America at the moment in terms of religion.
Yeah.
And then the whole experience of being in the seminary and how I finally summoned up the courage to trust my doubt, 9-year process. I had actually decided after 5 years that I would leave, and I was definitely gone. You know, it took me 5 years. And then initially my spiritual director was very healthy and responsible, and I thought, God, this is going to be so much easier than I thought it was going to be. Mm. And I thought I'd be gone very, very, you know, within days or a week or something.
Right.
But then he went off and he talked to another priest. And when he came back, he totally changed his tune. And it was all about, oh, you should stay another month. And this is a divine vocation. And you can't just be glib about it. And I looked at him and I thought, what credibility do you have anymore? Mm. To be directing me as my spiritual director when you are manifestly uttering stuff that you just got from a different priest, which is completely at variance of what your natural response was
right.
when I told you my decision I was leaving. But right. it had an effect on me, and I wasn't at that time, 5 years in, so I was 23, just still a bit young. I wasn't strong enough to leave. And it took me another 4 years before I could resist all of the emotional and religious pressure.
Yeah, that struggle is pretty evident. Yeah, when you finally made that decision, were you automatically an atheist, or did you go through some years of agnosticism? I did. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I wasn't automatically an atheist. I did have this experience. I asked to do counseling, and I had this experience, which is where I got the title for my book, In My Gut, I Don't Believe. Mm-hmm. And the problem for me was I was stuck in my head. I could see a rationality for belief, and I could see a rationality for atheism. And I was terrified. I couldn't get out of my head. I could see it could go this way, it could go that way. Mm. There's a valid argument for God. There's a valid argument against God.
Right.
Valid argument for vocation, valid argument against it. And I just, that was me stuck on that fence for 9 years. And she just came over and she said, get out of your head, in your gut, this moment, what do you believe? And I kind of froze. And I literally became aware of my gut, my physical gut. And I thought, like, am I to decide my identity, my belief system, my future, my financial status, everything.
On a sentence,
on the basis
basically.
Of my
on,
gut.
On a response, yeah.
Yeah, on a gut response from me.
Yeah.
Disregard what the Pope says, disregard what the church says, disregard what anybody else says, and just make the decision on the basis of my gut. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't answer it. And she said, no, come on. And she just...
Forced you to it.
Yeah, and she said, no, come on, right this moment.
Yeah.
And that was it. I said, in my gut, I don't believe. And I've literally built my life on that. And you know what? It was also because any other option, I couldn't be sure was coming from me, but I knew that was me. I could really, I said, this is Joe. This is me. This is nobody's putting this idea in my head or in my gut. This is my gut. And my gut says, no, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
So, but despite having had, and that was a huge thing, which enabled me to leave.
It's appropriate title to your first book. Yeah.
But very despite meaningful. despite having had that experience, now second book, having explored those the next 6 years after I went mm-hmm. out on a leave of absence, my head is still full of religion.
Yeah. You know? It takes so long to get out of your system. And even now things pop into my head and I'm like, that's a religious concept.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a LGBTQ issue or euthanasia or something like this. Like, why do I think that way? And it almost always comes back to your religious upbringing. You know, it's not a secular point of view. I had a little different. When I finally walked out of the church and I decided, you know, I don't want to go back. I still was an agnostic for about 12, 13, 14 years after that, just kind of exploring different options, different ideas. And I try and encourage people to about that now. You know, you can leave Christianity, you can leave your religion. But if you want to have a perception of God, try and expand it just a little, you know, get away from this anthropomorphic God that's in the Bible, this awful, awful.
A man-made God.
Of a God.
They're all man-made.
They're all man-made. And now as we're marching onwards here with, you know, these incredible discoveries of life and the cosmos,
science,
and everything, it should be at least expanding our perception of God. It's not that we have to have one or invent one, but.
And the thing is, like, I find when I listen to really clever scientists like Brian Cox and, you know, physicists and Carl Sagan.
I actually, sorry to interrupt, but I'm just discovering Brian Cox.
He's amazing.
So I'm mesmerized when I watch him. Watched a 20-minute video of him last night. Yeah.
No, he's amazing. And
yeah.
But like the spirituality, if you want to use that word, of non-belief is to my mind so much more compelling and universal and fact-based than all the baloney you get from any religion. You know, it is astonishing that matter evolved to become conscious matter. We are conscious that we are us.
Yeah.
Self-consciousness, you know, that matter actually evolved to that point, and that we exist for a momentary, fragmentary, fleeting second in terms of the history of the universe and the size and space of the universe.
It's mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. But heck, we're alive now. This is our only time to be alive, and we're alive now. I find that so exhilarating and exciting. Do you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting that you mentioned that, because those were the exact thoughts that I was thinking of last night. He was just going on and on. I was like, oh my, this is so much better than thinking about God. It is so much more thrilling and exciting and just full of this potential and everything. And it's an interesting that you kind of mentioned that, because I really kind of just discovered him this past week.
And it's devoid of all the control and the guilt and the negativity and the mind warping of religion.
Yeah.
You know, it's free. It's full of wonder. And the other thing, of course, we so often get from religious people is, what's the basis for morality? And I say to them, hang on, are you honestly telling me that if you didn't believe in God, that you would go out and rape and murder and pillage? And they'll say, no, I wouldn't. Well, then why do you have to believe in God in order to be good? It's a nonsensical belief.
I think it's just an old excuse that people come up with. I'm not even sure people have thought about that. In fact, I try and make the case that you can actually, perhaps you can kind of relate to this. One of the reasons I left Christianity was to be a better person, to re-engage with humanity, but also because sometimes religion will make you do things that you don't want to do, that goes against your conscience and your sense of right and wrong. And unless you pull out of that environment, if you're in it, you're just stuck in it. You've got to go along with everybody else, but you have to pull out of that. So I think in a lot of cases, you can be a better person by leaving religion. MAGA comes to mind. You know,
The only thing I would say is that in my experience, you know, there are loads of lovely people who are religious. You know, loads of people I'm very fond of who are religious. And there are loads of lovely people and whom I'm fond of who are not religious. Equally, there are lots of nasty and toxic people who are religious.
Right.
And there are lots of nasty and toxic people who are not.
Right.
And one of my...
There's good and bad atheists too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's good and bad in all of us, you know. But yeah, I have been appalled at times looking at secular organizations and, you know, humanist organizations. And I can see in them all of the faults of a religion. You know, I can, like, for example, if you have a humanist organization and it has its celebrants, and I'm thinking, if you know the history of the church, if you know the history of the development of the priesthood, you know, the clerical caste, the very same thing is happening within some humanist organizations. If you know the history of, you know, if you have this view of the early Christian community owning all things in common and so on, but then how do you get from that to this autocratic monolith of Catholicism where, you know, the Pope,
right,
from the Pope
right
down? And there are humanist organizations which are so like that. They're just autocratic. So
it's a
humbling kind of thing for me to realize it's just to do with human organizations that you get these tendencies to impose structures and to reduce freedom, even in organizations where you think, surely to goodness, that's not going to happen, you know, in, let's say, a humanist organization. It does.
Yeah. Well, it's got people in it, right?
It's got people.
Yeah, it's got people. And it's just the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, it's been great chatting with you.
My pleasure.
We should do it again sometime.
Absolutely.
Maybe kind of focus on a couple of specific topics or something, religious wise. Do you have a YouTube channel?
I do. I have two. One, I have a podcast called Losing My Religion.
Okay.
And so, if you know, Google Losing My Religion, Joe Armstrong, or other podcasts called Losing My Religion too, but this is Losing My Religion, Joe Armstrong. And so I have a podcast, but I also have a YouTube channel connected to that. And my other YouTube channel is, because I'm a humanist celebrant, although I do very little of it these days, but I still have stuff on my other channel. And if you get onto one channel, they're linked. So you
Okay. I don't know how I missed that. I have to check them out. I sure enjoy your blog.
Thank you.
Yeah, you have a very
just Joe the Human, my Substack. I love writing. I'll do it tomorrow, you know.
Yeah.
And I love the Substack model or format or whatever.
Well, it's very light. I have found it's very light. It's not theological or anything, but it's very I'm trying to describe it. You know, you just have a different way of writing. It's very light, very humanist, very thoughtful, very compassionate, empathetic.
Thank you. Thank you. I've written journals all my life, so it's kind of an extension of my journals. And I also have a kind of a crazy idea that maybe I'll write more memoirs and maybe they'll sort of catch up with my Substack. And
I was wondering if you have a next book in the works.
I've loads more journals. That second one, Saved by Woman, takes me up to 1995. So
I've had a bit
of life between then and now.
You got some more to cover.
I've got some more to cover, and I've got loads more journals.
You have the life after religion to cover.
I do.
Which is kind of the best part.
Absolutely. Never happier. And this wonderful woman. I married that woman. Yes.
You know, maybe I'm hoping I'll get a chance to come visit you.
I'd love to. You'd be very welcome. We got spare bedrooms here, so
that would be excellent.
That would be cool.
I will plan on that.
Good. Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. Great talking with you.
Thank you. And the Substack is called Joe the Human. Look it up.
Joe the Human. Thank you. And I'm going to give you a little intro when I create this video, and then I'm going to put a lot of your information down into the description and everything. So we'll make sure we get everybody pointed in your direction.
Brilliant. Well, the important thing, I guess, if somebody gets onto Joe the Human Substack, they'll find everything else. They'll find a podcast. They'll find the YouTubes.
Okay. I'll make sure I highlight that then.
Yeah.
Great.
Scott, you're a star, and I want to hear more of your music.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Cool. And I'll see you in Ireland. Patrick's Day this weekend, you know.
I've got to go see Molly, the statue Molly.
Molly Malone. Yes.
Molly Malone. I read an article on Molly Malone last week.
Yeah. Do you know the song?
No.
Oh, in Dublin's fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first set my eyes on sweet Molly Malone. As she wheeled her wheelbarrow through streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. Alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh. Crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh.
There are three verses. The second verse. Yep. She was a fishmonger, and sure 'twas no wonder, for so were her father and mother before, as they both wheeled their barrows through streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. Alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh. Crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. Sad verse coming up.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
She died of a fever, and no one could save her. And that was the end of sweet Molly Malone. Now her ghost wheels her barrow through streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. Alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh. Crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. What a way to end your show! And Patrick's weekend is coming up on the 17th of March.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I got to try some of that Guinness.
You do. Good on you, Scott. This one has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, you take care,
man. I didn't know I'd be ending up singing.
Bye, all right,
Scott.
Man. Take care.